It is truly a great honor to give a lecture in the Gerlich House. For me, this has an additional overtone, since the books of Paul Halmos have played a special role in my mathematical formation. I will never forget a long conversation I had with Paul about mathematics and mathematicians, and he has many things to say about mathematics. More than a quarter of a century ago, soon after I arrived to the United States, and I decided not to go back. Today's lecture will be on the interplay between mathematics and robotics over centuries. Technically speaking, the history of robotics is very short. Started somewhere around World War II. However, the idea of the robot may be as old as the early mathematical discoveries. It has always been a special component of the human psyche. And I hope that in today's lecture, I will manage to convey this message convincingly. By analyzing the myth of Pygmalion, the golem, Frankenstein's monster, and other automata of legend, a framework emerges for understanding how different cultures express desires and fears about technology and the future. Before embarking on the historical journey of robots and their interplay with mathematics, let us define the terms from an etymological point of view and from the point of view of their contemporary usage. So, Encyclopedia Britannica defines mathematics as the science of structure, order, and relation. And originally, the Greek word mathema had a very general meaning designating learning, study, science. Aristotle uses the plural ta mathematica in a more restrictive sense. All things mathematical for him means numbers, proportions, and geometry. Now, the Romans, notably Cicero, use also a plural, a neuter plural, mathematica, in Latin is the neuter plural, and so is the English word mathematics. It first came into writing in 1573, probably borrowed from the French mathematics. Now, in the fall of 2008, I attended here in DC at the Carnegie Institution a truly exceptional public lecture on the shifting meaning of mathematical truth delivered by Enrico Bombieri, who is one of the greatest mathematicians alive. And he also defined mathematics as the science of relations. He forgets about the structure and order. And he stresses the fact that what is important is the relation between objects, not the objects themselves. Now, Professor Bombieri was very kind to send me the slides of his lecture, from which I borrowed this wonderful image depicting Euclid and his students. Let us leave mathematics for a while and turn to robotics. The same Encyclopedia Britannica defines a robot as any automatically operated machine that replaces human effort. The word robot was introduced to the public by Karel Čapek in a play that premiered in 1921. It is interesting to remark, though, that Karel Čapek did not coin the word robot himself. Now, in Czech, actually in many Slavic languages, robota means work, or eventually serf labor. In a letter written in connection to an etymology in the Oxford English Dictionary, Karel Čapek designates his brother, the painter Josef Čapek, as the actual originator of the word robot. On the other hand, everybody agrees that the word robotics was coined by Asimov, the famous science fiction writer. Now, I could not find any famous painting depicting robots. I went to several museums. Therefore, I chose images of actual robots. Oh, this is Asimo by Honda. It stands about 4.5 inches high and 4.5 foot height. Actually, let me check it exactly. It's 4 feet high and weighs 114 pounds. Okay. Anyhow, it can walk and run on 2 feet at 4.3 miles per hour. Now, the KUKA robot, like most industrial robots, doesn't have any resemblance to human beings. On the other hand, the Actroid ER looks very much like a robot. She has greeted people at a lot of expos around the world in 4 languages, and she has appeared recently in many TV commercials. The International Organization for Standardization and the Robotics Institute of America have even more restrictive definitions of a robot. History of robots that conforms to these definitions would not go too much in the past. Therefore, in this talk, I consider the sort of more general definition of an automaton. And I chose to illustrate this definition with the digesting duck, which is the most famous automaton, actually, of the 18th century. The duck had over 4,000 moving parts, could flap its wings, drink water, digest grain, and defecate. Although Vaucanson's duck supposedly demonstrated digestion accurately, his duck actually contained a hidden compartment of digested food. So that what the duck defecated was not exactly the same as it ate. Now, although such frauds or hoaxes were sometimes controversial, they were common enough because such scientific demonstrations needed to entertain the wealthy and powerful to attract their patronage. Some people from the National Science Foundation here. We don't want to sort of demonstrate any hoax here, but eventually, in the next proposal I'm going to write, I'm going to overstate a little bit the eventual impact of my research. As we'll see in this talk, hoaxes have, in fact, a rather positive impact on the development of robotics. After seeing the duck, Voltaire compared Vaucanson, duck him as Prometheus's rival, in reference to failed economic policies of the King of France, he ironically remarked that sans le canard de vos consoms, vous n'auriez rien qui fit ressouvenir de la gloire de la France. So without the duck of vos consoms, you have nothing to remind you of the glory of France. So this is how important this Pemberton was. It's actually considered a miracle of the 18th century mechanics. It was the century when scientists were very confident that they could reproduce everything through mechanics. And of course, what they managed to bring about was the French Revolution. Speaking of hoaxes, I'd like to mention the Turk, the legendary chess-playing machine that beat Benjamin Franklin and Napoleon, among others. While certainly a hoax, von Kempel and Sterk spurred considerable technological research for the next couple of centuries that culminated in the construction of a chess-playing machine that eventually beat the world chess champion. So with all definitions and hoaxes out of the way, let us have a look at the fascinating history of robots and automata in chronological order. Its origin is to be found in myths. Now here I could find a good picture by Rubens. So legend has it that Hephaestus, the ancient Greek god of fire, metalworking, and handicraft, forged 2,000 copper tripods which could move about the place on golden wheels as if they were self-propelled. Hephaestus had a limp, and therefore, he also forged two maids out of gold that supported him by the hand while accompanying him during outings, waited on him, and amused him with their singing. They were in possession of every piece of knowledge taught by the immortal gods, according to Homer's Iliad. And I use that quotation from Homer just to show you sort of how old the idea of a robot is in the history of mankind, and in fact that we would like to have robots that would be in possession of all knowledge there is to help us. Now Zeus also ordered Hephaestus to forge a giant by the name of Talos to defend the island of Crete. Now he had an old metal body topped with a horned head. There was a single artery running from top to toe of his body plugged with a copper nail. Now what's happening, the sorceress Medea just unplugged his artery and his black oily blood ran on the ground, and as a result, Talos' strength thinned out, and Crete became extremely vulnerable to enemy attack. Now, taking advantage of this fact, last fall, a large army of mathematicians, including myself, converged on Crete for a large mathematical convention. We charged it on our NSF. Now, I will continue with one of the most powerful myths of humankind, the myth of Prometheus. He is a titan known for his wily intelligence who stole fire from Zeus and gave it to mortals for their use. According to Plato and later to Ovid, he is also credited with the creation of humans out of clay. Therefore, humans may be considered as robots of gods and titans. Prometheus's creation of humans without prior consultation with Zeus was not viewed kindly. As a punishment, he was bound to the distant on a mountain in the distant Caucasus, and every day an eagle swooped down to gnaw his liver, which grew back every night to be ready for the next day's agony. Undoubtedly, in speaking of Dr. Frankenstein as the modern Prometheus, Mary Shelley had in mind Prometheus' punishment as well as his feat of creation. Now I will continue with a romantic myth, the myth of Pygmalion, and a very beautiful painting by Jean-Léon Gérôme depicting the moment when Pygmalion's statue is given life by Aphrodite. Her name was Galathea, and she was the first female robot. There are many other myths from different cultures that I could explore, but I want to finish with the myth of Golem, who gained a high status in the popular culture after the release of the German silent movie Der Golem. So during the reign of Rudolf II, the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague, the Jews were either to be killed or to be expelled. And to protect the Jewish community, the famous Rabbi Löw constructed a golem out of clay from the banks of the Vltava River and brought it to life through rituals and Hebrew incantations. As this golem grew, it became increasingly violent, killing Gentiles and spreading fear. The emperor begged Rabbi Löw to destroy the golem, promising to stop persecution of the Jews. Now, to deactivate the golem, the rabbi rubbed out the first letter of the word emet, meaning truth or reality, and leaving just the word, the Hebrew word met, which means death. So again, this is a programmable robot, right? Change one letter in the code. It is time now to move from myth to history. So around 2500 BC, the Egyptians built statues containing hidden priests that would speak to the citizens. Ah, this is another example of a hoax, the history of politics. King Mu from the Western Zhou dynasty in the 10th century BC made a tour of his empire, and a very skilled artisan by the name of Yang Shi made a robot to entertain the king during his tour. Apparently, this robot could sing and dance like a real person. Around 400 BC, Archytas of Tarentum, a friend of Plato, supposedly built a mechanical pigeon capable of flying, powered by steam. Now, philosophers, notably Aristotle, were also thinking about automatons and tools capable of working independently of people. Ctesibius of Alexandria, a remarkable mathematician, invented a water organ and an improved water clock called Clepsydra, which was the most accurate clock until the Danish Christian Huygens, the Dutch actually physicist Christian Huygens, detailed the use of a pendulum to regulate the clock. Now, the greatest follower of Ctesibius in antiquity was Hieron, or Hero of Alexandria. His major work, entitled Metrica, was lost until 1896. I chose for illustration here his famous formula that gives an area of a triangle in terms of its semi-perimeter and sides, and his most famous invention, which was the first steam-powered engine. Now, closer to robotics, this is a reconstruction of the platform of his mobile theater. This platform could come automatically across the floor on wheels to face an audience. And on top of the platform, there was a mobile theater composed of six automata, including Dionysus, the Greek god of wine, along with female worshippers that performed a short show. And when the show was over, the vehicle trundled off stage. I want to cite from Noel Sharkey, who's professor of artificial intelligence and robotics at the University of Sheffield. Hero's idea was so elegant that even as I read it, the hairs on the back of my neck stood on end. It also struck me that this mechanism provides the basis of a simple programming language. And he proves, in fact, that this is a programming language. Of course, it's programmed by ropes, and that's why the article from the New Scientist is called I Rope Box. Okay, Al Jazari was a mechanical genius of the Muslim world. His corpus was entitled The Book of Knowledge of Ingenious Mechanical Devices, in which he describes 50 types of mechanisms. But what is even more relevant to this lecture is the fact that he built musical, programmable musical automata, and there is independent verification of the fact that this automata played to entertain the guests of his patron. I conclude the presentation of Al Jazari with two photos of the splendid reproduction of his elephant clock, in which automata reacted after certain periods of time. There is a humanoid automaton here, striking the cymbal, and this is a mechanical bird that chirps after certain intervals of time. And I have seen this automaton in the Ibn Battuta Mall in Dubai. You can see there many other marvels. So, don't want to. The next contributor to robotics needs no introduction. Although no robot survives, there is plenty of evidence that he actually built several robots. So I want to cite from the famous book of Giorgio Vasari, Le vite delle più eccellenti pittori, scultori ed architettori, where he says that when Leonardo was at Milan, the king of France came there and desired him to do something curious. And accordingly, he made a lion that walked towards the king and offered him lilies, which were the symbols of the king of France. And the king was very impressed with this and took Leonardo with him and went back to them. Very important is to note that, again, this line was programmable. It could do different things, not only one thing. And this is apparently not the first programmable robot built by Da Vinci. According to some sketches that were found in the 50s by Carlo Pedretti, it is almost certain that he built a humanoid robot shortly before he painted The Last Supper in 1495. Now, some other sketches had surfaced in the 60s and 70s, and using those sketches, Mark Rosheim built a model based on Leonardo's sketches of a robot for NASA. And Mario Taddei from the Politecnico di Milano claims to have an even more accurate reproduction of Leonardo's robot. And I'm going to finish with a nice image of his robot and with the basic mechanism designed by Leonardo da Vinci. Now, from what the documents that have survived, it's very clear that Leonardo was a great roboticist. But was he also a mathematician? So this talk is about mathematics and robotics. Apparently, yes, but none of his mathematical work survived. There is something in let's say, you could call hydrodynamics. But what we know is that he studied mathematics under Luca Pacioli and prepared a series of drawings of regular solids for Pacioli's book. So this is a drawing by Leonardo, for example, that appears in that book. Now, more than a century and a half would have to pass before somebody came even close to Leonardo in the field of robotics. And the first scientist to come close to Leonardo was the brilliant Jesuit scholar, Athanasius Kircher, who built a number of automata like the ones listed here. But what I'm most impressed with is his Arca Musarithmica, which according to David Levi is the earliest example of artificial creativity. So this machine could compose music on a given theme. Now, he was a brilliant mathematician. In fact, he taught mathematics at Collegio Romano. He taught also physics and Oriental languages. Anyhow, he wrote 44 books, 2,000 papers, so he would deserve a good NSF grant. The next step in the history of interplay between mathematics and robotics pertains to the discovery of the computer. There's an important component in that interplay. And although some forms of computers may have been known from antiquity, like this Antikythera mechanism found in a Roman ship that sank off the island with the same name, I will start with Pascal's mechanical calculator. Blaise Pascal started to work on it when he was 19 years of age to actually assist his father, who was a tax commissioner. Now, his calculator could only add and subtract, which was enough for the tax commissioner. And it took about 30 years before a computer was built that could do all four arithmetic operations. And that was done by another mathematical genius, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. Now, what you have here is a picture of a modern replica of Leibniz's step reckoner in the Deutsches Museum von Meisterwerken der Naturwissenschaft und Technik from Munich, which I visited 2 years ago. And he built this machine because he thought that it is beneath the dignity of excellent men to waste their time in calculation when any peasant could do their work just as accurately.
So that's still being argued today.
Should we teach our students to add? besides the calculator, Leibniz made many other contributions to what we call today computer science. He is considered to be the greatest logician since Aristotle. His calculus ratiocinator anticipates aspects of the universal Turing machine, and Norbert Wiener, and his name is going to appear several times during my lecture, as it has during my interview, claims that Leibniz's writings contain already the notion of the feedback. What I chose here for illustration are two sort of famous formulae from calculus. I just wanted to stress that Leibniz's notations, unlike Newton's, survives today. So who invented calculus? I'm not going to answer that question. What I want to say is that this notation survived. The 19th century brings fundamental contributions to the field. You have noticed that I skipped 18th century. I have not. I showed you its most famous automaton, Le Canard de Gérardin. But Charles Babbage was the most prominent contributor to robotics, if you want, in the 19th century. He was also a formidable mathematician. He was a Lucasian professor of mathematics at Cambridge. He shared this honor with Newton, who was the second Lucasian professor. Stephen Hawking, who just resigned his professorship, I think, in September of last year. And the present Lucasian professor is Michael Green, one of the pioneers of string theory. So, no doubt that Babbage was a great mathematician. He was also a great roboticist and computer scientist because his analytical engine could be programmed using punch cards. And this machine was designed to employ several features that are used in modern computers, including sequential control, branching, and looping. And it would have been the first mechanical device to be Turing complete. Now, Ada Lovelace, George Byron's daughter, a accomplished mathematician, and one of the few people to truly understand Babbage's idea, created a program for the analytical engine. had the analytical engine been built, her program would have been able to calculate a sequence of Bernoulli numbers, which is not so easy. So because of that work, she's considered to be the first computer programmer. And a modern computer language, Ada, developed by DOD, just recognizes her contributions to computer programming. In fact, a manuscript survives in which she describes the program fully, and it's implementable, no doubt about it. Another giant of the 19th century was George Boole, who invented a new type of logic in 1847, instrumental to the creation of computers and robots. His algebra of logic, now called Boolean algebra, is basic to the design of computer circuits. But he was also a great mathematician. In 1859, he wrote a treatise on differential equation, followed the next year on a treatise of calculus of finite differences, which these two treatises were used well into the end of the 19th century, beginning 20th century. Now, my favorite mathematician is Norbert Wiener, and as Ivers told you, my high school reading of his autobiography made me decide to pursue a career in mathematics. Now, I'm going to mention his name in about 10 days when I'm going to talk to the parents of talented and gifted students in Baltimore. And here is an example. He graduated high school at the age of 11, got a BA in mathematics at the age of 14, and then started to study zoology at Harvard. Now, 1 year after that, he moved to Cornell to study philosophy. He came back to Harvard and got a PhD at the age of 18 on a dissertation of mathematical logic. I didn't understand initially what that had to do with zoology, but in fact it has. Because his major work, Cybernetics, on the control of communication in the animal and the machine, really uses his deep knowledge of zoology and biology in general. He shows here that feedback, right, is essential both for machines, for animals, and for humans. Now, this is a fantastic piece of work, this book, and around 1940, he had written a paper in which he anticipates computers and so on, but he phrases everything in philosophical terms and in terms of, let's say, analog computers. Because both men and animals, we are not digital computers, right? I'm going to come back to that controversy later. Sufficient to say that during World War II, he gained invaluable experience by working on the automatic control of anti-aircraft firing weapons, and he used feedback and control in his work for the Department of Defense. Actually, he lived in Arlington during that time. Now, all the scientists I talked about before were born, let's say, before the 20th century. Now, here is the one that's born at the beginning of the 20th century, who brought tremendous advances to the field of robotics, computer science, and mathematics. Well, I hope that in a future lecture I'm going to talk about scientists which were born in the 21st century, because I'm pretty sure that they'll have even greater contributions. Anyhow, John von Neumann, in Hungarian, Margitai Neumann Janos Lajos, was called by Jean Dieudonné as the last of the great mathematicians, because he was the last of the mathematicians that knew all mathematics. You can see here everything, but eventually number theory. The only notable exception is that he didn't make essential contributions to number theory. He was also a prodigy as a preschooler. He could joke in classical Greek, and he could quickly memorize a page from a telephone book and recite the names, telephone numbers, and addresses. He was also a Princeton legend. It was said that he played a number of practical jokes on Einstein. Unlike the stereotypical mathematician, whatever that stereotype is, we see it on TV, but he was known as a wit, bon vivant, and aggressive driver. His frequent auto accidents led to a Princeton intersection being dubbed the von Neumann corner.
They didn't consider providing him with a chauffeur.
He would have been provided with a chauffeur in the Soviet Union. All scientists, they were provided with chauffeurs. In order to be controlled, right? The chauffeur had a degree in the KGB. And in India, for example, scientists still have chauffeurs. I mean, they're big scientists. I have a friend that moved to India. I had the chauffeur. Okay. Now, let's go to Alan Turing. Again, major contributions to a lot of fields. Before going into sort of computer science, he had a remarkable work in the theory of relativity, but his interest embraced cryptanalysis, logic, philosophy, biology, computer science, more or less the same as Wiener, von Neumann, and Turing machines that he introduced around 1936, so pretty early, are basic abstract symbol manipulating devices which can be adapted to simulate the logic of any computer algorithm. Now, all this is taught in computer science courses. What's controversial is the so-called Turing test, which he introduced in 1950 in a paper called Computing Machinery and Intelligence. Here he proposes a test whether or not a machine has gained the power to think for itself. And it's controversial because a judge actually has to hear both a human and a computer in responding to some questions and so on. So I have some friends that say it's important. I have some friends that say, well, don't bother about it. But All my friends agree that the most important contribution to computers and robots belongs to Claude Shannon. Robert Gallagher called him actually the greatest scientist of the 20th century. You may agree with that or not. But I'm going to give you another citation here. Namely, according to Neil Sloan, the perspective introduced by Shannon's communication theory, now called information theory, is the foundation of the digital revolution, and every device containing a microprocessor or microcontroller is a conceptual descendant of Shannon's 1948 publication. He is one of the great men of the century. Without him, none of the things we know today would exist. None of the things like this, I mean, other things. The whole digital revolution started with him. Now, his major work was published in two papers in 1948. They are mathematically elegant. But as far as I'm concerned, they are not as deep as the concepts from the Book of Vienna. However, they are expressed in digital terms. And the war between digital and analog seems to be over, is it? Some people speak now of new types of computers, the biological computers and things. So, for the time being, round one belongs to Shannon. I don't know if it will be any round two, but my favorite mathematician is still Norbert Wiener. Now, following the major contributions of Wiener, von Neumann, Turing, Shannon, and many other brilliant scientists that I don't have to mention, the pace of discoveries in robotics has accelerated. Given the time allocated to my talk, how much time do I have in time? So that I know when to finish. 10 minutes, right? Well, then I have to really accelerate the pace of my presentation. So, 9 minutes. brings us the first expert system. Also, the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence that puts artificial intelligence on the map. The world's first computer company. Then 3 years later, the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT. 61, a computer-operated mechanical hand. First industrial robot in the same year. First artificial robotic arm to be controlled by a computer in 63, and in 66 we see the first mobile robot to know and react to its own actions. So these are 10 years condensed, which brought us the first robot to know and react to its own actions. Now, we see all kinds of arms that were built in 68, in 69, in 74, in 76, the sub-gripper is really something, but 77 is very important because this was the first mobile robot that was autonomous and had a computer. Now, the Stanford cart is rebuilt by Hans Moravec, I'll come back to him. With a most robust vision system and allowing greater autonomy. So now we see sensors put on these robots, including vision system. We have the first walking robot in 89. Then in 93, we witness the failure of Dante, not a name to fail. Followed by the success of Dante 2 the following year. And then 96, Robert Yuna, the same year Honda has his first autonomous humanoid robot, the Pathfinder mission lands on Mars, we have the a robotic pet, Abo, in 99, and in 2000 Honda has his a better version of P3 called Asimo. Now in 2000 I organized at NSF a workshop on mathematics and robotics. I'm going to talk more about it in a minute if I have time. 2008 FDA clears robotic surgery and we have the NASA rovers landing on Mars a little bit later. But 2005 is very important because we witness the entry of a major power player in robotics, Korea. Now, I have with me, for those interested, a recent report, a couple of months old, that shows us that the United States is about number four now in the world, behind Korea in terms of robotics. And we'll have to discuss about that soon. Now, again, in 2006, we have Starfish capable of self-modeling and learning to walk after being damaged. The first unmanned robotic surgery took place in Italy, not the place. We have entertainment robots. Boss created at CMU, won this important DARPA competition 20 minutes ahead of competitors, so apparently the robotics center at CMU knows what it's doing. The same year, Toyota unveiled a robot that can really play the violin. Nexi can show a wide assortment of facial expressions. In 2008, the Phoenix lander descends on Mars. Scarab is tested in Hawaii. And according to the best estimates I have, there are now more than a million robots in operation worldwide. In an article featured in Scientific American, Bill Gates anticipates that the number of robots is going to grow exponentially and is going to mark a new industrial revolution. And the problem is number four in the world right now. It will mean a lot of jobs, and it's important to invest in research and development in robotics because many people think this is going to be the sector of the economy with the most important growth, about 10, 15 years from now. But we don't think in terms that long, 10 years too long. I told you about some robots developed by NASA. A former PhD student of mine, Zhang Yan, who got a PhD with me in 1990, sent me some beautiful picture. Here is the robotics banner of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And here is the Opportunity rover, which started in 03 and landed in 04. And Zhang Yan wrote RSVP, the Rover Sequencing and Visualization Program, which is used for the final generation of command sequences for the mission and for the planning and validation of all mobility and manipulation service activities. This is what Jen told me. But he's also one of the rover drivers. Now, Jen is a member of the team that built the most sophisticated space robot in existence, the Phoenix Lander, who touched down at landing site in the Martian Arctic on May 25, 2008, and the stationary lander's mission was to search for signs of potential habitability on the red planet. And on July 31st, it confirmed the existence of water ice and the fact that this ice was once liquid. And in a previous slide, I also talked about the workshop that I organized at the National Science Foundation. I was very fortunate to bring together some of the best mathematicians, computer scientists, and engineers. And the workshop identified some basic unsolved problems that impede wider deployment of robots. And here are the areas that we identified then. Some of the problems have been solved, many have remained yet unsolved, and there are a couple of new problems that have appeared. Just a month ago, I wrote to the participants in the workshop, as I was preparing this talk, to ask them about new developments in the area. And I got a lot of information, but it's too technical to be presented here. I chose for illustration some beautiful work by Robert Graf. Actually, I took this illustration from Michael Erdmann from CMU, who uses the work of Robert Graf. He was first with this idea of using topology and geometric group theory in robotics, and the STOM program is really having a lot of success. Actually, according to an email from another participant, Matt Mason, who is the director of the Robotics Institute at CMU, this work is the most interesting thing that has happened in my area. Okay, so he's the director of that institute, which is probably the best in the world in terms of research, and probably he knows what he's saying. I'm going to talk about Mihai Anițescu, who was the youngest participant in the 2000 workshop. He's now at Argonne National Laboratory, and a paper that came out, a joint paper with him that came out from his thesis, formulating dynamic multi-rigid body contact problems with friction as solvable linear complementarity problems. I talked to Ivers about this. Has a lot of citations. And what's important is that it's being used both in national labs and by private industry. So having efficient methods to solve such equations, right, is important in robotics. But I'm not going to brag too much about that. Mihai Anițescu is working now for simulation of systems containing more than half a million contact points and more than 2 million unknowns. And systems like this will be used in the control of the future atomic power plants, which, if the president has his way, are going to be built soon enough in the United States. Okay, now the future. These are slides that I got are by Hans Moravec. He's the author of the robotics entry in Encyclopedia Britannica, and they are from 2000. But I chose them expressly to see how, and Hans was very, very nice to send them to me. So he predicted that by 2010 we'll have robot vacuum cleaners. Well, we already have them. It is Roomba, as seen on TV. Please buy one. It really works well. I'm not getting anything from the company. Now, by 2015, according to Hans, larger utility robots will be in use, having the brain power of a frog. Let's wait until 2018. By 2020, larger machines will sort of execute application programs with reptilian inflexibility. Now, all these predictions are based on computer power, as measured in MIPS per $1,000. Now, why MIPS for $1,000? Because if we want a robot to be in everybody's home here, the computer controlling it should not cost more than $1,000. Now, although reality tends to exceed predictions, as shown by these trends, we are still far from being able to get the brain power of a mouse for $1,000, and a year for $1,000. Okay. So the largest computers in existence can perform more than a quadrillion floating operations per second, and there are only two of them right now, according to Top 500. A Roadrunner built by IBM for Los Alamos and Cray XT5 Jaguar from Oak Ridge National Laboratory. They would be able to control a very smart computer, robot. However, it won't be a mobile robot. And it would kill your electricity bill. So new technologies have to be invented in order to have a truly intelligent robot with the brain power comparable, let's say, with the human brain. And I'm convinced that such technologies will be invented. In the not-too-distant future. History goes by leaps and bounds. So, yeah, I don't bet all my money on it, but I together with other specialists, we expect new technologies to really give us the possibility of having a very powerful computer in a very small place in the not-too-distant future. So, will mathematics be able, provided that we have this technology, to solve remaining difficult problems that impede development of highly intelligent robots? So I'm asking this question because today the robotics community stands at the threshold. While in the past technology lagged behind theory, the situation is about to be reversed. The analytical engine of Charles Babbage could not be built in his lifetime because the technology was not there yet. Around World War II, mathematical geniuses such as Wiener, Turing, von Neumann, Shannon have set the theoretical foundation for contemporary robotics. And then computer scientists and engineers have developed the technology to implement those ideas. Today, we have very fast computers, very good sensors, sophisticated mechanisms, new materials. But according to many specialists in the field that I talked to, it is for some still unsolved mathematical problems that we have failed to deliver one of the most tantalizing promises of the modern age. I believe that the answer to this question is yes, and that we will witness in our lifetimes the deployment of truly intelligent robots, fulfilling thus one of the oldest dreams of mankind, as expressed in myths, legends, and the effort of many mathematicians and computer scientists.